and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the New York State Tobacco Cessation Center Collaborative Conference Call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Anne Wendland. Ms. Wendland, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Rachel. Good afternoon. This is Anne Wendland, Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, I'd like to welcome you to today's call, Five Essential Strategies in Motivating Patients to Quit Smoking. If you have not downloaded the slides for today, presentations and eventually all call recordings are posted on the collaborative call page of the New York State Smokers Quit site at nysmokefree.com. For today's presentation, on the left-hand side of the website's homepage, you'll see a news feed section. Directly under this heading is the announcement of today's call. Click on the link provided, and it'll bring you to today's presentation. Our featured speaker today is Dr. Marilyn Harry, Director of the TEACH Project at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health and the Director of Collaborative Program in Addiction Studies at the University of Toronto, where she is also an assistant professor. On today's call, Dr. Harry will discuss practical strategies to motivate behavior change and how you can adapt these strategies with your clients. Lastly, she'll also discuss how to set concrete objectives for clinical practice. Before we start, I have some housekeeping items. We're pleased to offer CME, CRCE, and OASS continuing education credits to listeners of today's presentation. To fulfill the requirements of continuing education credit, we're required to disclose that Dr. Harry has no affiliations. To disclose, to obtain continuing education credit, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms, which are posted on the New York State Smokers Quit site. Please remember applications for credit will not be accepted after November 14th. That is 1 week from today, so please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible to receive credit. Now it is my pleasure to turn the call over to Marilyn Harry. Dr. Harry?
Thank you so much, Anne, and it's a pleasure to be here with everyone this afternoon. I really appreciate the invitation. So on your slide deck, you'll see that there's the title slide, a disclosure slide, and learning objectives. Anne has already kindly covered. So if you could just advance the slide to a hypothetical scenario. And here's a hypothetical scenario I'd invite you to consider. So you have, if you want to look at the next slide, just say, imagine that it's Monday morning, and you are getting your coffee, and you'll see that IV bag with full of French roast Starbucks coffee. And you're on your way to work, and then if you advance, you'll see the calendar, and that's your calendar for the day. And as you open your calendar, and maybe it's electronic, maybe it's a paper version, you notice that the very first three patients that are booked are the three most, let's call them most challenging patients that you have. Maybe these would be the individuals that if you were to see that they had canceled their appointment with you, that you wouldn't be very depressed about that. And maybe these are the individuals that you find when you've had a really rough day, that these are the ones that you're thinking about. So I just invite you to consider, how are you feeling right now in response to this scenario? And some of the emotions or thoughts that might be going through your mind might include feelings of frustration, feelings of that kind of learned practitioner helplessness that happens when we aren't able to feel very effective with individuals, might be feelings of irritation with that person that here I am spending all this time with you and, you know, you're not really doing very much to change. Might be, you know, other feelings of, you know, am I doing a good job or what else could I be doing? So I put the image of the kind of sad-looking pug dog in the slide deck to just kind of symbolize that sometimes it, you know, in spite of our best efforts, there's this sense sometimes of almost an adversarial relationship that can happen with a patient. And if you ever have noticed that in conversation with patients that you feel like you're working harder than they are, that you care more about whether they quit smoking than they do, that those are the kinds of scenarios that I think for us as practitioners make it really challenging to feel excited about coming to work or feel excited about working with that individual. I'd also ask you to just think for a moment about how do you think that those three challenging patients are feeling about coming to see you? Might they be having some of those same emotions or thoughts of frustration, irritation, anxiety, feeling like they're not doing a good job, etc.? So it's interesting when we look at it from both perspectives, there can be this kind of similar dynamic that happens. So the happy dog on the next slide is really meant to symbolize that hopefully at the end of this lunch and learn session that you'll feel like you have some additional tools in your toolkit that when you are confronted with those challenging patients, and maybe it's not Monday morning, maybe it's Thursday morning, maybe it's tomorrow morning, that actually you're looking forward to seeing them and to try out some of these tools and see how they work for you. So my goal is to be really practical. I'll talk briefly about the evidence base for motivational interviewing and what it is, but what I'd really like to get to are the key strategies. What are my five favorite or top strategies in motivating patients to change? So the evidence base for motivational interviewing is pretty extensive. At this time, we're not really wondering, does it work? There's been over 200 randomized controlled trials now demonstrating the effectiveness of motivational interviewing. Our concerns or questions are really around how does it work? And I'll talk more about that a little bit later on. But if you look at that screen snapshot of a Google Scholar search, and this was a search I did about a year ago just out of curiosity, where in Google Scholar I entered motivational interviewing, and you can see that at that time it was just under 50,000 hits. Now, that's not nearly as many hits as the Psy Gangnam Style video, which I don't know if any of you have teenagers or teenage nieces or nephews or what have you, but I think that video has, I'm guessing, up to about now 650 million hits. So 49,000 doesn't look like a lot in relation to that, but certainly in terms of the evidence-based literature, that's a lot. That really is a lot of publications. On the motivationalinterview.org website, you can see that there's a bibliography that I want to just highlight and direct you to, because that actually is a wonderful repository of virtually everything that has been published about motivational interviewing, including doctoral dissertations. It's a really nice resource that if you haven't checked it out, chances are you will find, if you look at it, specific, very targeted, population-based research that may be appropriate to the diverse communities and populations and patients that you're dealing with around tobacco cessation. And just to note that research publications have been doubling every 3 years, approximately, with respect to testing the efficacy of motivational interviewing. So we can say with confidence that it's an evidence-based intervention. And if you look at that slide from 2010 from Bill Miller around motivational outcome studies by different eras, you can see that in the late 80s, early 90s, when motivational interviewing was first developed by Dr. Miller, it focused on alcohol. That was his area of practice at that time, an area of interest. And that over the years, you can see that although alcohol research specific to motivational interviewing has continued to be an important line of research, the range of different problem issues and behaviors that have been addressed has been increasing. And you can see that smoking in that last highest bar is actually now forming a significant body of evidence base around motivational interviewing applications. So on the next slide, I've just prepared a list from a recent meta-analysis just from a couple of years ago, just to share the range of different ways and settings in which motivational interviewing is being used by practitioners. And so the strategies that we're going to talk about this afternoon don't just focus on tobacco cessation, because chances are the patients that you're seeing have a multiplicity of other kinds of issues too, right? They're probably coming with co-occurring medical disorders, as well as mental health disorders, other addictions, financial issues, occupational concerns, relationship issues, criminal justice, child welfare, housing, etc. So it's often not just one area of focus. It may be multiple focal points in our interventions with patients. And what we're talking about is extremely relevant across the board. So the skills are totally transferable. So we have thousands of publications. We have tons of acronyms. And I took it upon myself to compile a list from the literature of all of the different acronyms that I have come across in my own reading. And if any of you who are on the call have other acronyms that you've come across, please send them to me, and I'd love to add them to my glossary, because at the end of this presentation, you'll see at the end of the slide deck, I prepared a glossary of what these different acronyms stand for. We're going to cover a couple of those in this call, but just to flag that these, I didn't make any of these up. They are actually published in the literature. So I have this question mark because it's like, okay, we have thousands of publications. We have tons of different acronyms. Where do we look? How do we distill it down to kind of what are the essentials, the basics? And that's what I've attempted to do. So here's my top five essential strategies in motivating clients to change. Now, I just wanted to qualify this by saying with this quote from Dudley Field Malone, where he says famously, "I've never, ever in my life learned anything from anyone who agreed with me." And so I just want to put out that this is my own perspective on motivational interviewing, having practiced it for the last 15 years. But there are many different opinions and ideas about it, and the field and approach itself is constantly evolving. So I'd also welcome people's feedback during the answer period at the end of the call. So as we begin, I'd invite you to look at this confidence ruler and write down or circle on the slide if it's in front of you in print, or just write it down on a piece of paper if you have one handy. Where are you at with respect to your current confidence in practicing the skills of motivational interviewing? 0 would be no way, and 10 would be I'm Bill Miller. And if you're wondering who Dr. Miller is, then chances are you're not towards that latter, higher side of the scale. Dr. Miller is, of course, the originator of this approach. He's based at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. He's now, I don't know if semi-retired is the right word. He is sort of stepping back a little bit from his work, but still extremely active in research, teaching, and clinical practice. So I think he's also, you know, very vocal on the Motivational Interviewing Network of Trainers listserv. So it's really lovely, actually, to have the voice of the person who has originated the approach so front and center in terms of willingness to respond and discuss different ideas about it. So on the next slide, you can see this glass of water that says, first, empty your cup. And I like Zen stories. I'm going to just read you a little short Zen story, because I think coming into any kind of learning context, it's nice to kind of set the context, because I suspect that there are folks here who have months, years, or perhaps decades of practice in motivational interviewing, while others, it may be completely new to you. And so let me just tell you the story. So the scientist goes to visit a famous Zen master. And while the master is quietly serving the tea, the scientist is talking about Zen and about all the things he wants to learn. And so the master is pouring the visitor's cup to the brim, and the master keeps pouring. So the tea is gushing over the top of the cup, just like in the cup that you see in front of you. And the scientist is kind of getting perturbed by this and watching this overflowing cup until he can't restrain himself anymore. And he says finally to the Zen master, "It's over full. No more tea is going to go in." And the Zen master replies to him, "Well, you're like this cup. How can I show you Zen unless you first empty your cup?" And to me, this story represents two things. The first is that we want to keep an open mind. And I think, you know, motivational interviewing, cognitive behavioral therapy, solution-focused therapy, dialectical behavior therapy, these are all technical strategies, but they're also ways of being with our patients. And in all cases, I think if we just keep that open mind and look for ways to adapt and make it work for that patient, that's really evidence-based and also patient-centered care. The other is that, in a way, we're all beginners. There's a really nice quote that I like that says, to the beginner, there are many possibilities, and to the expert there are few. So remain a beginner always. And so I think, you know, regardless of how many, as I said, months, years, or decades we have in clinical practice, as well as experience in motivational interviewing, the beauty of this is that none of us ever get perfect at it. We can always take it to the next level. So if we can agree to approach this topic as true beginners, recognizing that regardless of where we're at, we can all continue to grow and improve. And that's kind of the spirit that I'm coming at this with. So here, without further ado, is the first of the top five strategies, and that is to resist the writing reflex. So what is the writing reflex? It truly is a reflex. It's something that we almost can't control. If we can't control it, it's really hard to control it, and we need to be really present in that moment and on our best practitioner behavior in order to control that writing reflex. So what is it? So you see this picture of a hand, someone taking their pulse, and I'd like to show you a couple of pictures, and I'd like you to just notice the extent to which you feel concern for the individuals in these pictures or images. So the first image I want to show you, you can see this elderly woman who's lighting her cigarette off her birthday cake with candles representing 100 years old. So ask yourself, do you feel like this woman desperately needs to quit smoking? Are you worried about her? Maybe this picture doesn't activate your writing reflex particularly. You might feel like, well, she's made it to 100 and let her keep smoking. Or alternatively, you might think, well, I wonder what her quality of life is like. And in fact, in our clinic, about 2 months ago, I do clinical supervision with our interprofessional team, and there was an 86-year-old woman who came for tobacco cessation counseling. And it was interesting to hear the reactions of the clinicians on the team, because even though we're specialists in tobacco cessation, the reactions ranged from, that's fantastic, she's really great, what took her so long, to other reactions saying, wow, 86, why? Why now? Like, why would she even bother? She'd kind of beat the odds. But what turns out is that this woman had sought, she was actually a health practitioner herself. She had sought alcohol treatment in the 1970s. At that time, she was able to resolve her alcohol use problems. She had maintained her abstinence. Her tobacco use had never been addressed. And as she aged, she developed macular degeneration. Her vision was already severely impaired, and her ophthalmologist informed her that quitting smoking was really the only way to arrest further deterioration of her vision loss. So for this individual, this elderly woman, her motivation was something that was very real and very important to her in terms of her quality of life. So I think often we come with assumptions, and it was just a really interesting case to test some of those assumptions. The second image, here's an individual, a man who's smoking, and he's saying to you, I only had a minor heart attack, so, you know, what's the point if I can't enjoy my life? So this might be a bit more provocative for us, and we probably hear these kinds of statements quite often. I'm a vegetarian. I exercise. I do everything. Smoking is the one vice I allow myself. I know I should quit, but things are really stressful right now. All of those kinds of statements that kind of activate in us this notion of wanting to help the person. And so I have this slide of Batman and Robin, practitioner to the rescue, wanting to jump in and really make it better. And I think it's especially challenging for us as health practitioners because that writing reflex is almost part of our personality. I think most of us got into this field because we want to be helpful. And yet it's almost counterintuitive that when we try to make it right, when we jump in with solutions, that often evokes this yes, but response. So if you've ever been in a situation, whether it's with a patient in a consultation, or maybe it's in your personal life with family or friends, and you hear someone say to you, yes, but, that is a signal. They have just given you feedback that you have fallen prey to the writing reflex. People, we often label that as resistance. When the patient is giving us a series of yes, buts, we'll often say to our colleagues, you know, this person is just not motivated. They're really resistant to change. But in fact, the yes, but is a response to our own behavior as practitioners. So the lovely thing, I think, about motivational interviewing is that we can get training, we can go to conferences and courses, we can read books and articles about it, but in the end, our patients are our best teachers. So that yes, but is a great signal to us to take a step back and try it again in a more motivational way. Now, it's not to say that we don't ever provide information or suggestions to patients. It's how we do it that is either motivational or not, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. So this picture demonstrates the kind of counterintuitive nature of wanting to resist the writing reflex. In this snowy road, which I think most of us, whether it's in here in Toronto or in New York State, will be dealing with some snowy roads pretty soon, that if you are in a skid, if you lose control of your vehicle on that snowy, icy road, how do you get out of the skid? Do you pump the brakes? Do you jam on the brakes and steer away from the skid? That's kind of our instinct, right? But what happens then is you lock up the car and you crash. So what you're supposed to do is actually gently pump the brakes and steer in the direction of the skid, which I don't know. I've never actually tried to do that. I'm not sure that I could because it feels so counterintuitive. But similarly, that notion of rolling with resistance in motivational interviewing, and really, I think, in a more current framing of it, resist the writing reflex. Go with where the client is at. So this notion that motivational interviewing is always a conversation, it's always a collaboration, and it's really about evoking the solutions, ideas, preferences, hopes, dreams, fears, etc., from our patients, as opposed to installing those, as opposed to giving those to the person. And the image of the two men who are looking at a map together, I think, is a really nice illustration of the guiding style that motivational interviewing is so characteristic of, where it's not clear which of them is a guide or which one is a follower. They're both looking together and jointly determining the route that they're going to take. Now, you might be wondering, well, what if the person, like, what if they don't change? I've reached a dead end. I've used all my motivational interviewing skills. I've been to this teleconference call. I've tried all five of the top strategies, and the person's still not changing. And I love the idea of sort of behind these two quotations. I kind of collect quotations. So if any of you have any good quotes, I'd also love for you to email them to me after this conference call. The first from Gandhi, where he says, well, a no uttered from the deepest conviction is better than a yes merely uttered to please or worse to avoid trouble. And I think that sums it up for me so beautifully, because it's a win-win from my perspective. The person, better for the person to tell me that they're not interested in quitting than to go along and be polite with the treatment plan that we've worked so hard on and then not follow through. And if this has ever happened to you, then the question to maybe ask yourself is, was the person really honestly intending to change, or did they want to avoid a lecture or want to please the practitioner or just want to, you know, make themselves look good in that session? And so giving that person permission to just kind of put the cards on the table, I think at least gives us a sense of where the real terrain lies and where we might need to go with that person. And then Samuel Butler famously said in the 1600s, and demonstrating, I think, that motivational interviewing has really been around for hundreds of years, he that complies against his will is of the same opinion still. So it may well be that even if we're able to persuade someone to change in the short term, that in the long term, chances are they will revert back to their original behavior. And any of us who has ever been talked into buying anything by a really good salesperson may well still have the clothing with the price tags on it hanging in our closets and not be too excited about returning to that salesperson or to that retail environment. So I think what we really want to do is understand where the person is at and create the conditions in which the person is willing to really be candid with us. So ACE, the acronym that I want to talk about in this first skill, stands for autonomy versus authority, collaboration versus coercion, and evocation versus education. And this really encapsulates the spirit or philosophy of motivational interviewing. Dr. Miller talks about the spirit as being more important than the skills. So if there's one takeaway from this brief time that we have together, it's that just maintaining that sense of autonomy, collaboration, and evoking from the person where they want to go is more important than all of the skills that we bring to the table. It is primarily a way of being with that patient. And if you're trying to sort of formulate or frame in your mind how this fits with other interventions that you're using, I like to think of it as, you know, the metaphor of a wall where the paint is peeling off, that we can't apply the brush or the intervention until we've prepared the wall for change, until we've prepared the patient for change. So you can think of motivational interviewing as preparing that individual to receive the intervention, whether it's cognitive behavioral therapy or pharmacotherapy or some other kind of treatment approach. And then just quotation by Carl Rogers that I think really encapsulates the notion of autonomy so nicely, that people are most able to change when they feel free not to. Okay, so let's move on to number two. Now, you might be wondering, how are we going to get through all five? It's 12:30. We're only on number two. But we were kind of setting the stage. The spirit is the most important, and we will wrap up around 12:45 to give time for questions and some additional information for you. So number two is evoke versus educate. And that's accomplished through the four foundation skills of motivational interviewing, the second acronym that I wanted to share called OARS. And OARS is like the rowboat where you're using the OARS skills to advance your progress with that person in terms of enhancing their motivation to change. It stands for open-ended questions, statements of information, reflective listening, and summary statements. And I just wanted to highlight that I think we all know what open-ended questions are, but it's really interesting how when we're working with youth, that I think youth are unique in that they can turn a really good open question into a closed-ended question. So, for example, asking your teenager or a teenager that you know, so how's school going? Or what was your day like? Is really, I mean, it's amazing how they can just evoke a one-word response. So having said that, I think in general, open-ended questions are a helpful way to evoke information, ideas, strategies from our patients. But reflective listening is, I think, in many ways, the most underutilized and yet most powerful of those OARS skills. If there was one area in those OARS foundation motivational interviewing skills to practice, I think with most practitioners, the value add is practicing reflective listening. So I want to just drill into it for a couple of minutes and show you a little bit of what I'm talking about and how the way reflective listening is used in motivational interviewing is qualitatively different than how many of us were taught to use it and the way it's used in many other clinical psychosocial interventions. So I think of this metaphor of an iceberg, where the top of the iceberg represents a simple reflection. And that's what most of us often think about when we think about empathic or reflective listening. And that means sort of paraphrasing back or offering back primarily the content of what the person has given us. But underneath the waterline of that iceberg are all of the massive amount of hopes and feelings and ideas and emotions and thoughts that that patient is bringing behind the statement that they're making to you. And that the complex reflections in motivational interviewing are the most effective, in my experience, in advancing the conversation and communicating that sense of empathy, empathic, unconditional positive regard and understanding that leads to the really efficient way of building a collaborative relationship with that patient who's sitting across from us. I just wanted to highlight that I had the honor of having lunch with Dr. Miller a few months ago when he spoke at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, and I got my courage up to share my metaphor with him that this was a way that I had been teaching and understanding reflective listening in motivational interviewing. And I don't know if any of you have seen the new edition of their textbook. Dr. Miller and Stephen Rolnick put it out just last month. So just published the motivational interviewing textbook. And I've bookmarked page 58 because he actually gave me a credit at the bottom of the page. That's my equivalent of 15 minutes of fame in motivational interviewing, and included this metaphor in the textbook. So here's an example. So the patient is saying, I'm tired of people going on about my smoking. I know it's bad for me, but so are a lot of other things out there. And so an example of a simple reflection would be something like, so people are really on your case about this, even though smoking's not the only harmful thing out there, right? So that's kind of just reflecting the content of what the person has said. But if we just wanted to dip our toe below the water, get a little bit deeper, and it's kind of like hypothesis testing, we might say something like, it's frustrating because it feels like, why pick on the smoking? And do you see how that second statement actually gets at more of the meaning behind what the person is saying and would encourage them to elaborate further? Another example of a simple reflection might be smoking has some negative consequences and so do other things. Or we could deepen it and say, so from your perspective, smoking's not the most harmful thing to be concerned about, right? So again, just going that bit deeper. A lot of people are pressuring you about something you already know is unhealthy, a simple reflection, or plunging down even deeper below the surface of the water under that iceberg, it's like nagging, and that doesn't feel very supportive or helpful. So you notice how reflective listening can also be done very strategically. Each of these different statements will take the conversation in a slightly different direction. So we can steer the conversation using auras, using reflective listening, in the direction that we would like it to go. But it's not done in a manipulative way. It's done in a way that is very patient-centered and always emphasizing that spirit of motivational interviewing. Similarly, the deeper we plunge below the surface of the water, into that icy cold water, the deeper the conversation will go. So with a patient that you don't know well, you may want to just dip your toe in. With a patient that you know very well, a deeper reflection may be most helpful. Now, I don't know if anyone here is eating a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich, but that sandwich on the screen looks really good. And what I wanted to offer as a way to use those oral skills in busy healthcare environments is to talk about elicit, provide, elicit, a motivational interviewing sandwich as a way to offer information that is offered in a motivational style. So what we're talking about then is starting by first evoking or asking or reflecting what is it that you already know, for example, about nicotine replacement therapies, or what is it you already know about different strategies for quitting smoking. So first evoke the client's understanding, then offer a bit of information, and my general guideline is offer a lot less information than you think you should, and then reflect or evoke for further information or understanding from that person. And you can cycle through that in a series of ask, tell, ask, or elicit, provide, elicit throughout the conversation. And what I've done at the end of the slide deck is appended a kind of cartoon script that really slows it down and illustrates elicit, provide, elicit in a nice pictorial, graphical way so that you can get a sense of what that looks like in practice. I just wanted to also highlight this Chinese character, which shows the verb to listen. And this, again, reflective listening is something that we can't do effectively unless we're really listening. And what I love about the character in Chinese for to listen is that they talk about listening not only with our ears, but also with our eyes. What's the person's body language? Or what are we hearing behind in the tone of voice if it's over the telephone? Listening with our undivided attention. How many of us can multitask as we're listening? We're also thinking about, do I need to pick up some milk on the way home? Or, wow, there's five patients in the waiting room. Or I have, calls stacked up waiting for me to get to them. Perhaps most important, listening with our heart. And that gets to the notion of compassion that Dr. Miller and Dr. Rolnick are talking about, particularly in this new edition of their book. And then I was doing this talk for a group at the Ontario Dental Association convention, and one of the participants came up to me afterwards and said, there's another part to that character, which is a small character that stands for imperial, which symbolizes that the person you're listening to is the most important, which I thought was a really lovely addition to that. So the third strategy is to affirm the person's autonomy. And out of all of them, I think this should be the simplest for us and yet can be the most challenging. So if you look at the slide where we have some different things that we might say to someone, it's your choice whether to make this change. But if you keep smoking, you won't be able to heal from that surgery as well. You know, you're the one that has to decide this, but it seems like this diagnosis might be a wake-up call. Regardless of what you do, I'll be here to support you. Do you see where I'm going with this? But I do strongly advise that you quit. And so when you have the but statement, it effectively disqualifies the emphasis on individual autonomy. So the takeaway from this strategy is at some point in the conversation with that patient to hear you say, and say nothing else, it is your choice whether to make this change. Decide this. Regardless of what you do, I'll be here to support you, and then just stop talking. Just try not to put in that but statement. Again, it's not to say that we don't give information. We talked about elicit, provide, elicit as a way to do that, but to intersperse a statement of saying, especially when the person isn't really keen on changing or is really ambivalent, to just say, you know, it really is your choice. That's something, a decision that only you can make. And thinking back to that quote from Carl Rogers that says, people are most able to change when they feel free not to. So number four focuses on clarifying goals. And this gets at some of the complexity among patients that we see. So you may be seeing, as we talked about at the beginning of this session, people with multiple coexisting diagnoses, mental health, medical, other kinds of issues. It may seem like tobacco is just one of a multiplicity of different concerns. So agenda setting can be a helpful way to articulate what are the key areas that the patient wants to work on. And it's really for the patient to decide, in collaboration with the practitioner, these are my top priorities. So the bubble sheet that you see with all the empty circles represents an agenda setting worksheet. And if you have 10 or 15 minutes, and that's all, to spend with someone who has lots of things that they could or want to discuss or maybe don't want to discuss, I like to start the conversation by saying something like, so in the next 15 minutes, sounds like there are lots of possible things to talk about. Can we take just 2 minutes and populate this sheet with absolutely everything that you or any other practitioner or maybe your partner or others are saying that you should be working on changing? And then let's put it all on the table. Just get all those cards on the table, and you can see a variety of different things in the slides. And then ask the patient, so in the next 15 minutes, the time we have together, what's your priority, or what are your two maybe top priorities to talk about to make sure that you get what you came for today? And that gives the individual the autonomy, not just in their own behavior, but also the autonomy from a healthcare standpoint. And I think that that's really being supported in the current literature, thinking about, for example, the Stanford model about patient self-management, where it really is wanting to put the patient in the driver's seat around his or her own health care and route towards wellness. We can also preface or end the session with a readiness ruler, asking the person, you know, so if we've come up with this treatment plan, how important is it for you to actually take your medication as prescribed? Or how confident are you that you'll be able to take this medication twice a day as prescribed? And we were talking again with some dentists. You know, they prescribe medication for quitting smoking prior to oral surgery, and physicians will do this too quite often. But do they actually ask, how confident are you, or how important is it for you to actually take the medication? Because what often happens is that people don't take the medication, or they don't take it correctly, or they don't quit smoking. Okay, so just coming on to number five is highlighting change talk. There's some evidence, beginning evidence, for a causal chain for motivational interviewing. Teresa Moyers looked at some recording sessions from a large clinical treatment trial and actually coded therapist utterances and client utterances, looking for therapist adherence to motivational interviewing practices and skills, and then looking for patient change talk. And what she found in those video recordings was that there were significant differences among therapist motivational interviewing consistent speech. She also found that therapists who had the highest proportion of motivational interviewing consistent speech also had clients who had the highest proportion of change talk. And what's really interesting about that study is that they had excellent follow-up rates. Two-year follow-up data showed that those patients who had increased client change talk, significantly more change talk in their sessions, also had improved treatment outcomes 2 years post-treatment. And this was 4 sessions, brief motivational enhancement therapy, manual-based. So although this is still at a preliminary stage, I think this research is really promising, both in terms of highlighting the importance of evoking change talk from our patients, but also as a line of research that can help us look under the hood, so to speak, to better understand what is it about motivational interviewing that works? What are the active ingredients? And what Moyers concluded was essentially what practitioners reflect, they will hear more of. So we want to be reflecting the change talk and not the sustained talk. And change talk and sustained talk are really opposite sides of the coin, where I show these pictures from the Simpsons cartoon where we have Patty and Selma, and on the one hand, their change talk might be, you know, well, we know smoking is unhealthy, but it's part of who we are. There's the sustained talk. It's not resistance, it's just ambivalence. We have Homer Simpson who's saying, you know, I shouldn't eat all these donuts, but they really taste good. Or practitioners, we're also not immune. I should practice this motivational interviewing stuff, but I'm booked back-to-back with patients. There's no time. What we want to do then in this last part is listen for the change talk, and we don't always hear it. Just like this FedEx logo, if you look for it carefully, you'll see that there's kind of a subliminal arrow embedded in it. And if you aren't sure where that arrow is, ask your colleagues. Probably someone knows where it is. They'll show you. Once you see it, you'll never forget it. So just in these last couple of minutes, I want to do a very quick demonstration that will help you to better hear the kind of change talk from your patients. So this is our last acronym, Darn Cat. We often hear the CAT statements, that kind of change talk, which is commitment, action, or taking steps. I am going to quit smoking. I've already started this medication. I'm already attending groups. What we don't often hear are statements of desire, ability, reasons, or need as explicitly change talk. Our statements are change talk. They're preparatory change talk. It just feels a little bit harder working with preparatory change talk. It's like hiking uphill versus once the person is in that stage of action, the mobilizing change talk, it feels like smooth sailing with them. So here's an example. The client's saying, I want to be around to see my kids grow up. What would that be an example of? Probably you might think reasons for change, right? I want to be around. That's a reason. Okay, fair enough. That's change talk. But well, here's another one. What about this patient who's saying, I don't have a problem with cigarettes. I can quit anytime I want. Well, you might characterize that as resistance, denial. This person, that's not change talk. But look at that statement closely. What does that illustrate? Think about it. Ability. I can quit anytime I want. So as practitioners, we might be very tempted to go for the resistance part. I don't have a problem. That might be the part we want to engage with. But if we go in the direction of the change talk, that takes us down a very different path, and that will evoke more change talk. So what is it that makes you confident that you could quit? Or under what circumstances do you feel like you would need to quit smoking? Those kinds of questions would evoke more change talk. I've been abstinent all week, but the cravings were really bad. Again, here's an example of someone who's actually taking steps. Oftentimes, what we hear is the person is struggling. They're not doing very well. They're at risk of relapse. But if we want to go, if we want to build motivation and move in the direction of change talk, then we'll focus on, so you've been abstinent all week. That must be really hard. What were some of the strategies that you used? That will evoke more change talk. Again, just this one focuses on, I'm not here because I want to be here. My doctor told me I had to come here to get on the transplant list. Again, we might not consider this particularly change talk, but this is a reason. They've given you a reason. So if we go in the direction of the change talk, that would be something like, so what are some of your doctor's concerns? Or why is it that you think your surgeon is so insistent on you quitting smoking before having this transplant? Again, it may be a bit counterintuitive, But what I'd encourage you to do is when you're in conversation with patients, be listening for those desire, ability, reasons, and need. And here's an example that I think none of us have trouble characterizing as change talk, where I've quit smoking, quit drinking, joined a gym, no more processed foods, and turn off my BlackBerry every day. I think many of us are still aspiring to that level of change talk. When you're not sure where to go next, when you're not sure how to respond, I would just say, tell me more about that. And I don't know if everyone remembers the original version of Grease with the young John Travolta, Olivia Newton-John, but that famous song that they sang. I'm not going to sing it right now. So just to wrap up, I learn what I believe as I hear myself speak really encapsulates the notion that it's what the patient says, not what we say, that's the most memorable. And I came across another quote, an Arabic proverb, that says, the word you keep between your lips is your slave. The word you speak is your master. In other words, once the person says it out loud, now they need to deal with it. Now they need to do something about it, especially if they've said it to another person. So the more we can evoke versus educate, the more we can collaborate versus coerce, and the more that we can emphasize autonomy versus, you know, our own authority as a health practitioner, the more motivational our sessions will be. So in summary, we talked about resisting the writing reflex, evoking versus educating, affirm autonomy, clarify goals, and highlight change talk, which you can see creates yet another acronym for our list of acronyms, REACH. So I'm now going to hand it over to Pat Box, who's going to provide some information about upcoming events, and then we'll have a few minutes for questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Harry, for your exceptional and very motivating presentation. And I want to also welcome our new and returning participants on our call today. And we certainly look forward to your continued participation in our conference call series. If you're not familiar with the New York State Smokers Quit Line, we are a free, confidential, and evidence-based cessation service available for everyone in New York State. And for those that are seeking help in quitting tobacco use, you can call the Quit Line directly, register for nicotine replacement therapy online, or you can also be referred through a provider. And we have many providers on the call today. And for those of you that may not be aware, we do offer free coaching, nicotine replacement patches, motivational support, extensive resources that you can find on our website, and you can print, you can download and print them in online smoke-free communities, social media, and our most recent feature that we've just added, our QR code messaging. So I do encourage you, when you have more time, to explore our website at nysmokefree.com for some very helpful and ready-to-use tools, especially our referral program that's specific to providers and employers and others that may be interested in referring patients to our services. So you can also call us at 1-866-697-8487. And the countdown does continue as we prepare for the Great American Smokeout next week on November 15th. Just a gentle reminder that we are available to help you with all your cessation needs for your patients and clients, including providing you with materials. We have a promotional Great American Smokeout flyer, and we have some tips and suggestions that our coach can provide for you. So please do contact us at 1-866-NY-QUITS. Thanks for your participation today, for all your assistance in helping your tobacco-using patients to become tobacco-free. At this time, Rachel, we will open it up for questions.
Certainly. The floor is now open for questions. If you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad. Questions will be taken in the order they are received. If at any point your question has been answered, you may press 7 again to disable your request. If you're using a speakerphone, we ask that while posing your question, you pick up your handset to provide favorable sound quality. Please hold while we wait for the first question.
Thanks, Rachel. And maybe while you're waiting for the first question, can I just call people's attention to the practice goals that are at the very end of the slide deck, just before those additional resources that I mentioned. And if there's one thing to do before you go to bed tonight, it's to actually circle where you're at on that readiness ruler and actually write down a concrete practice goal, because that's ultimately this hour, you're never going to get it back again, but that's what's going to give the most value, is how can you put some of these ideas into practice with your patients. So that was my pitch for really adding some value to this session.
The first question comes from Tanisha Damwin. Tanisha, please state your question.
Sure, thank you. I just wanted to thank you very much, Dr. Harry, for your presentation because I felt like I could identify with a lot of the different things that you were bringing up. I had a question about at what point, or is there ever a point where you can just safely walk away from a client and just say, you know what, you're beyond reach, or how would you go about finding the best solution and using the motivational interviewing skills to actually reach a client that is very difficult to get to follow through with some of the things that have been suggested in the sessions you're having with them?
Tanisha, I love your question. Thank you so much for asking that question because I'm sure it's on the minds of a lot of other folks too. And what it really gets to is this notion that the individual does their best efforts might decide not to change. And so I think, you know, from my perspective, that's really the patient's choice. If we have set the groundwork and created that collaborative relationship, that it may be that in this moment, the person has made a decision that they're not willing to change. But if it's not just kind of lip service, my door is always open, but that individual, say it's your patient, Tanisha, who says to themselves after they leave, you know, she really got me. Like she really, this is one person that I can actually talk to that doesn't judge me, that doesn't lecture me, that really understands me. Who am I going to go back to when I do want to make a change? Chances are it's going to be you. So I think, you know, it's not so much us saying I can't help you any longer as us really putting it out to the person, where would you like to go next? You're really in the driver's seat here. What would be the most helpful course of action? And really just inviting it from them.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Again, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad.
Yeah, it's 2 pages. You didn't get the UV one?
Never mind, that's a fail. I don't get the credit.
Wait, how come? I thought I gave everybody the UV page.
I found it.
You found it?
Okay. Again, if you do have a question, please press the number 7 on your telephone keypad.
And I would say Tanisha was really brave. It's not easy to ask questions on a teleconference line, so if you're holding back, you'll be doing everyone a favor by just putting your question out there. So in these last couple minutes we have, feel free. Take a risk. So could I make just a couple of quick comments while we're waiting to just see if there's one more question? Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Marilyn.
Thanks. Just to flag that if people were interested in seeing videos of motivational interviewing demonstrated, I've included a couple of links in the slide deck, but there's also some really nice ones, Merlo Labs, M-E-R-L-O, Labs. If you go on YouTube and search there, there's some excellent motivational interviewing demos as well. So those can be a really nice way to get a flavor of what it looks like in practice. And my contact information is also in that slide deck, as well as my education blog, my Twitter. So I really would welcome if anyone wants to get in touch with me directly, feel free to do so.
Thank you, Marilyn. Rachel, are there any other questions?
If there are no further questions in the queue.
Okay, good. I just want to make one more comment. The next collaborative call will be on Thursday, November 29th. It's entitled Smoking and Mental Illness, Break the Connection. Every prescriber needs to know. The start time for that call is 12 p.m. And on behalf of the New York State Department of Health Tobacco Control Program, the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers, and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, I want to express our appreciation for the excellent presentation today. And thank all of you who have also participated. This brings us to the end of our call. Have a great rest of your day. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. This does conclude today's teleconference. We thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your line at this time.
Okay, everybody, I have to go off of mute now because I have to talk.